Good morning and welcome to The Cosmic Influence. My name's Walter Cruttenden and I'm here with co-host Sean Freeman.
Good morning, everybody.
And we've got another show for you here. I think it's a pretty interesting one. We're going to talk about Atlantis. But first, for those that are not familiar with the show, Sean and I are working here at the Binary Research Institute in Newport Beach, California. And this is where we investigate things that have to do with solar system motion and the possibility that the mythical rise and fall of civilization might be tied to this motion. And to that end, we've produced a film on the topic, The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones, my book, Lost Star, Myth and Time. And we're working on another book, and we give a lot of talks and lectures on the topic. In fact, I'll soon be in England, where I'll be speaking at Conscious Events in London on May 6th. And if you're getting this podcast 2 years from now, that's May 6th, 2010. And also, we'll be speaking at the Glastonbury Megalithomania Conference, and that'll be on May 9th. And you can find information on either of those at Conscious Events. Just Google that. It's in the UK, or Megalithomania. So with that, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the book we're doing today. And Sean, can you...
Yeah, our guest today is Ian Driscoll. And he's a co-author of a book called Atlantis, Egyptian Genesis.
Co-author with Matthew Kurtz, I guess, huh?
Yeah, Matthew Kurtz. And one of the reviews from Amazon here is, this book offers a whole new way of looking at the Atlantis myth. Many other theories out there are interpretations that require a selective reading of Plato's myth, but Atlantis, Egyptian Genesis takes a fuller and more complete approach. The authors prove that Atlantis is a cosmological system that shares many significant characteristics with ancient global mythologies. Their similarities are stunning and will change the way you understand mythology and ancient culture.
Ooh, I can hardly wait. And I must confess to our listeners, normally I try to read the whole book or a good chunk of it. This one, I've only had a chance to read a little bit, but it is one of my favorite topics. So I'll be in your seat today and just... we'll try to get as much information out of Ian as we can. So, Ian, you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Okay, terrific. Why don't you start by giving us just a one-minute bio on yourself and your partner, Matthew, and then we'll get into the book.
Sure, no problem. Yeah, Matt and I met about 10 years ago while we were both still in school, and we were both sort of drawn to...
What school did you go to, by the way?
Actually, I'm speaking of high school, Sunny Hills High School.
Oh, terrific! Okay.
Yeah, Fullerton, California. And it was towards the end of that we found that we both had a common interest in ancient history and alternative history. Specifically, we were both reading Fingerprints of the Gods at the time.
Graham Hancock's book, yeah.
Exactly, which sort of opened our eyes to a whole new vista, you know, on world history, and from there, we basically have spent the last 10 years researching various aspects of not only the lost civilization hypothesis, but also comparative mythology generally. And
and this is something you're doing as your just for fun, as a hobby on the side.
Yeah, more or less. Yeah, exactly. I'm basically working on this whenever I have a free moment. And he's in the same boat.
What's your day job, if I may ask?
Sure. Yeah, my day job actually I work in wine. And he's a musician. So, you know, neither one pays too well. So this is sometimes tasking to stay on top of. But you know, it's a passion for both of us. So we try to get to this, you know, every moment that we can.
Good. And you've certainly taken a scholarly view of things from everything I've seen here, everything I've read, and. I think it's an excellent piece of work. So,
yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, we throughout the book, really, what we tried to do was sort of take take a position that stayed away from interpretation. You know, a lot of people would purchase this book expecting something closer to Fingerprints of the Gods and alternative history, and there is that aspect to it. I think it definitely has its implications, but what we tried to do is stay true to sort of a comparative mythology approach.
I think it's important, to understand, what are true histories and what are mythologies, and sometimes events are a combination of both.
Exactly.
And it looks like you're trying to parse that out here. And
yeah, that's our hope in this book. So yeah,
good,
definitely.
Good. Okay, well, let's sort of give our listeners an overview of, what the dominant Atlantis theories are right now, because there are many of them.
Sure. Of course, the most widely accepted theory in academia is the island of Santorini. That was destroyed about 1500 BC. This is an example of selective reading. in my opinion, it's the idea of sort of picking and choosing from Plato's narratives what fits your hypothesis and discarding whatever doesn't. And for instance, in Plato's narrative, he describes Atlantis as large as
Africa,
Europe and
Asia
combined,
right.
And he says, of course, it's outside the Pillars of Hercules, and he describes these concentric rings of land and water, and Santorini certainly does not possess any of these characteristics, and more to the point, Plato also places the destruction of Atlantis around 10,000 BC. And Santorini was destroyed, as I said, around 1500 BC. So there's a real problem of dating there, but it's not something that anyone lets get in the way of a good story. So
right, but it does. I can see how that idea came around because it's not far from Greece. It's where Plato was writing,
sure.
And it's it was ancient to him.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
a good-sized civilization was lost. I guess the Minoan civilization was was near its height when that
right.
went down.
And they've used they've used a lot of the art and architecture that they've been able to excavate on Santorini to bolster this hypothesis. But like I said, there are just too many things that don't seem to fit, and that seems to be the way in Atlantis research, at least over the last century, it has been this idea of selectively choosing whatever bolsters your thesis and ignoring whatever does not. And so we try, at least in this book, to stay away from that and to take a more neutral approach.
There's also the idea that Atlantis was outside the Pillars of Hercules, the Gates of Gibraltar there in the Atlantic. How about that one? That used to be quite prominent.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people have made much of that. And I do think it has to be. Well, like I was going to say, we come at this from the perspective of comparative mythology. And to me, the idea of Atlantis being situated somewhere to the west in an unexplored ocean is in keeping with the worldwide conception found throughout global mythologies of sort of an Elysian island of paradise found far to the west, where the sun sets. It's sort of this afterworld conception almost. This is not something that is foreign to creation myths, in the world. This is something very much in step with that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So there's over 100 books on Atlantis. I guess, what's your take that 99% of those are looking for some physical location. Are there some already that are looking at it more of a cosmological metaphor?
Yeah, there are a few out there, I think, that have dealt with that, mainly around the turn of the century, honestly, which is when a lot of the good books stopped being written. But Ignatius Donnelly, you know, of course, in his famous Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, he deals a lot with the mythological similarities. You know, however, he leans towards the interpretation that, you know, the myths are actually recording historical events, and then there's also W.R. Lethaby, who wrote Architecture, Mysticism, and Myth, and he very clearly views Atlantis as a creation myth. But you know, all of this was back around 1900, and since then, the literal interpretation of Plato's story has predominated, and you know.
Perhaps for good reason, in that archaeology has sort of pushed back the bounds of early civilizations. You know, when I was a boy, they thought it was no more than 5,000 years old.
Right.
And, of course, we've found many interesting discoveries since then.
Absolutely. And you know, that's also something that we try to make clear in our book, is that Matt and I continue to be supporters of the lost civilization hypothesis. We simply believe that that is a separate issue from Plato's Atlantis. I don't like the idea of using the two terms synonymously. Atlantis, as it's described in Plato's work, has to be treated for what it is, and in our opinion, evaluated in the context of worldwide creation myths, and you know, and that's what we try to do in this book.
Okay. Good. There's a couple of nice reviews I saw that you received in Amazon on the book, and it's received you know, some excellent comments there. So I just wanted to remind our listeners that if you're interested in the book, Atlantis, Egyptian Genesis, you can get it on Amazon or probably any of the major bookstores could order it for you. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is true. Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and yeah, it's available in any of the major retailers.
Okay, and you also have a Facebook site.
Yeah, we have a site on Facebook under Atlantis Egyptian Genesis, and you know, we have some lively discussions going there. So anyone interested, you know, is encouraged to participate.
Good. Right. Well, if Sean or I forget to ask a question, just go on Facebook and ask Ian yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's start a discussion.
Great. Okay, so there's this. Most people are in the camp that Atlantis is a real physical island, a real part of history. And I myself tend to lean towards that, although certainly there are metaphysical aspects towards the story as it's been passed down, metaphorical aspects. And I take it then from what I'm reading about your approach here is that you look at it solely as a cosmological story?
Yeah, and, you know, I also want to make clear as well that, you know, the opening line to our book, and we did this for a reason to sort of set a tone, is that, you know, what we're proposing here is not the answer to Atlantis. We don't believe that this sums it up. But it's one aspect of the Atlantis story that I don't think has gotten its due attention. And, so we try to look at it as a creation myth, as a diagram of a cosmology, and basically in doing that, you know, what we have attempted to do is sort of identify a number of the common features in creation mythologies worldwide, and sort of align that list to all of the features present within Plato's Atlantis narrative. And see what lines up and what doesn't, and you know, at the end of it, we try to make the case that, you know, there are too many things that seem purely mythological. For Atlantis to be judged sort of in this isolated bubble, you know, we can't. I think a lot of people in the alternative history community, especially, always criticize mainstream academics for, you know, sort of tunnel vision and becoming so specialized that, you know, they ignore evidence to the contrary in you know, other fields. So I think that's something that, you know, we all need to be aware of. And so in this book, we try to take sort of a more inclusive approach and get a bigger picture from it, if we can.
Yeah, I'm sure there's faults on both sides, but
yeah.
Okay, well, tell us then about. We just have 1 minute left in this segment, but what are some of the cultures then you look towards to find similar myths that?
Sure. I mean, very briefly, we go into the Greeks and Norse mythology and Hindu mythology and Persian mythology and Babylonian mythology, the Japanese, the New World. We try to, you know, sort of get a good cross section. And like I say, we come up with aspects of the myths, you know, certain commonalities that also fit the Atlantis narrative, Plato's Atlantis narrative, and, you know, the world tree, the world mountain, twins, pillars, concentric rings of islands, or land and water, you know, the central mountain, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so we basically take it from that perspective. And, you know, it's a way of looking at the Atlantis problem that hasn't been focused on enough in our opinion. That's sort of what we try to address here.
Right. Okay. Well, I think it might make sense then to really look at what Plato wrote, talk about some of the main points that he referred to as far as the size, the time, the features, the kingship of Atlantis, this sort of thing.
Right.
And figure out where you're finding parallels for those in mythology and really get into those when we get back.
Yeah, absolutely.
Terrific. Okay, well, you're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back. Okay, so Ian, obviously the first source for you must have been Egypt. And tell us, you know, what you're looking at in Egypt that fits or doesn't fit with the Atlantis story.
Yeah, absolutely. We concentrated in the main in Egypt on the mythology that's found inscribed on the walls of the Temple of Horus in Edfu, which is in southern Egypt, and it's a relatively new temple. It dates to right about 57 BC. It was built
Under the Roman era.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and it was built actually under the reign of 13 Ptolemaic pharaohs, and. But the mythology that's inscribed upon the walls is actually very, very ancient, and there are a number of mainstream Egyptologists even that attest to this.
And this is a site that's built on an older site, isn't that correct?
Yeah, this site is built on an older site. It's astronomically aligned to the Great Bear and to the constellation of Orion, which, you know, of course is Osiris and Set in Egyptian mythology. So you get an idea of sort of conflict already between Osiris and Set, between good and evil, you know, before even reading any of the inscriptions. But the mythology is very, very unique. It's almost demythologized, and it paints a very sort of human, sympathetic picture of the world of the gods. And basically, the story it tells is of an island civilization founded by the gods, and these gods are twin deities. They're very similar in essence to the Ogdoad of Hermopolis, and the Ogdoad was a group of eight deities, four sets of twins.
Versus the Plato story was five sets of twins, huh?
Exactly, yeah. And the Ogdoad, you know, the Edfu Ogdoad, founds this island and is ruled over by a central god. And this god is only ever referred to as this one. You get the sense that it's an earth god, but he sits atop a large pillar called the Jed, which means, you know, stability. And the Jed pillar was used in Osirian mythology to symbolize, some feel, his backbone. It's basically a horizontal pillar with four vertical beams attached to the top of it. And from this central staging area, and a temple is then built around this Jed pillar that serves as the seat of the original deity. And from this central staging area, the island is enlarged, and you know, the people are governed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and life goes on, you know, normally for it seems many centuries. The text really isn't clear, but quite a while. And finally, an enemy serpent comes and attacks the island. Once again, the texts are sort of enigmatic, but the serpent brings with it, or causes, a great storm to lash the island, and finally the waves succeed in completely inundating the island and drowning the divine inhabitants and destroying all of the buildings.
Okay, so there's another strong similarity to Atlantis.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I should as well mention that the Jed pillar is also prominently featured in the Atlantis myth. I mean, it's not called the Jed, but it is a central pillar of flashing orichalcum, which is sort of a reddish gold that was said to have existed in Atlantis. Mm-hmm. And it was upon this pillar in Atlantis that all of the injunctions of Poseidon, the god who presided over the land, were engraved. And so the central pillar sort of plays a similar role in both the Edfu narrative and in the mythology of Atlantis. But getting back to the Edfu story, once the island is inundated, it creates sort of this shallow, muddy zone with reeds sticking out of the ocean, and it's referred to as the Field of Reeds, which in later Egyptian mythology is the name given to the underworld, or, you know, the afterlife. It's the domain of Osiris, and but here,
isn't there also that sounds a little similar also maybe to the Sargasso Sea, or I understand the term Red Sea came from Reed Sea.
Absolutely, yeah, and the Sargasso Sea has actually been speculated to be that muddy area where Plato said that it, because when Atlantis sank, Plato said that, you know, proof of it was this impassable sea of mud that was created by the subsidence of the land, and many people have looked upon the Sargasso Sea as you know, fitting that description.
Yeah, that's sort of in the middle of the Atlantic.
Exactly. Yeah. And in fact, Aristotle mentions that, you know, there, once again, we have this similarity to Plato's Atlantis story. And after a while, two deities emerge. This is after eons and eons. I shouldn't just say a while, but two deities emerge from sort of an unspecified location and rebuild the island and defeat the enemy serpent, etc. So that's actually where the story is most different from the Atlantis legend, because in Atlantis, of course, it's simply destroyed and there is no reemergence of the island.
Right. Isn't there any reference to an earlier destruction of Atlantis and coming back in Plato's? There's none there then, huh?
No. No. Okay. It's right. it's just the
one
destruction. Yeah. He puts it as you know, the mortal element grew stronger than the divine, and so finally they were destroyed for their pride and arrogance and greed and vice and all of that. So
got it. Okay. Hey, why don't you hold it there for a moment? We'll take a short break. We'll be right back. Remind all our listeners, we're the Cosmic Influence, and we're talking about Atlantis, Egyptian Genesis. Okay, and why don't you take us into a couple of the other cultures that have similar myths then?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the best example, honestly, is going to be found in India, in the Hindu and Jain traditions. There you have, in India, you have basically the conception of the universe is sort of almost hourglass-shaped, and in the very center you have sort of the habitable world, and above the celestial and below the infernal. And this habitable world is described in very similar terms to the Atlantis geography. It's comprised of a central island surrounded by a ring of water, another ring of land, another ring of water, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In the Hindu conception, it's limited to seven. Rings of land, and in the Jain conception, the rings are innumerable. And
in Plato's account, did they ever say how many rings are there?
Yeah, in Plato's account, there are three,
okay.
Not counting the central island. And there are a number of interpretations for this. You know, the Neoplatonic philosophers actually looked at that as sort of being indicative of the orbital movements of the planets, et cetera. But in India, you also have the central mountain, which is paralleled in Plato's Atlantis by the middle hill, from which sort of the civilization flowers. And the hill in Atlantis is sometimes translated hill, sometimes mound, sometimes mountain, depends on the translator. What you get is sort of the conception of a great mass of land, you know, sort of bulging out of the middle of the ocean, and in Hindu and Jain cosmologies, you have that same central mound in the Hindu conception is called Mount Meru, and most people are at least familiar with the basic idea. It's the world mountain. That's situated in the exact center of the cosmos, and atop this mountain in Hindu cosmology is what they call the Jambu tree, which is sort of the tree of life. That's what it's most comparable to, and it puts forth the fruit of immortality. And in the Hindu conception as well, I should mention that just as in Atlantis, Plato specifies that the whole thing is surrounded by a mountain range, ranged in by mountains. In the Hindu conception, you also have the Loka Loka, which is basically the mountains that separate the habitable land from the outer darkness, I would also say that in Hindu tradition, generally, but more specifically in Jain tradition, the central landmass is said to be originally populated solely by twins, to have been ruled over solely by twins.
Oh, you find because, that same thing then.
Yeah, exactly. Because in the Golden Age, you know, in the first age when the gods ruled. Those are the only births that were acceptable. So it was only twins that were born to mankind during this golden age period.
This is according to Hindu cosmology. You're talking
exactly, about? And Jain, yeah, most certainly.
Okay. Huh. Okay. So go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. You know, there are certainly other examples. The Persian creation myth, which is very similar to that of the Hindus. You have a central island surrounded by six individual islands. You have the Persian equivalent of Mount Meru, which is called Mount Hara, and close by it stands the Tree of Life. And it too actually in the beginning the first mortal pair were said to be twins that grew out of this plant of life, and they gave birth to a succession of twins that went on to govern the rest of the island, and once again you have that range of mountains that encloses the whole cosmos. And so, I mean, you start to see that these themes are repeated over and over and over again throughout world mythologies. You find it, in Japan. You find it in the Americas. You find it in China. In some form or another, all of these themes reoccur. And so, finally, at the end of it, you have to reevaluate Plato's Atlantis in terms of these commonalities that seem so all pervasive in world mythology.
Okay. Does your book get into what some of the meanings are for the world tree, the central mountain, this sort of thing, or are you just pointing out that these myths exist and they're universal?
Right. Yeah. And honestly, that's that's more or less what we're doing. We are definitely trying, and this was intentional on our part. We were trying to confine ourselves to sort of a comparative take. So speculation on the meaning of the world tree or the meaning of the twins sort of exceeded the scope. We didn't want to. We wanted to leave ourselves out of it as much as is humanly possible, and so our final chapter in the book actually deals with some alternative interpretations of the Atlantis myth that have been put forward by various authors, ranging from the Neoplatonists that followed Plato to Ernest MacLean and John Michel, who of course wrote in the last 50 years. But in terms of our own interpretation, we made the decision at the outset to leave that out of it as much as possible.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. I'd like to talk a little bit more about some of those aspects. We're going to take just a short break here. You're listening to The Cosmic Influence, and we're talking about Atlantis, the Egyptian Genesis. Okay, well, you mentioned some of the alternative interpretations. Can you tell us what some of those are then?
Yeah, absolutely. We cover the Neoplatonists, and I talked a little bit about that before. Most of them felt that Atlantis should be interpreted metaphorically, usually as a spiritual allegory of some kind, though Proclus, who was a relatively recent Neoplatonist, he in his interpretation of the Timaeus said that he believed that not only was it a spiritual allegory, but it was also an authentic record of historical events. But in terms of modern interpretations, we wanted to sort of discuss the interpretations that hadn't really been given too much discussion time. One of those was put forward by John Michel in his Dimensions of Paradise, which is an incredible book dealing with sacred number and numerology in general encoded into ancient myth and ancient architecture. And in that, he said basically that Plato destroyed Atlantis. That basically the whole thing should be taken as a mathematical spiritual lesson, and that Plato destroyed Atlantis because it was based upon the number 10, which he felt to be an imperfect worldly number, whereas 12, the number of the zodiac, was the more perfect heavenly number, and. And so he felt that basically it was a lesson in sacred geometry in a sense, which is an interesting theory, though. As we point out in the book, a number of people have commented on the fact that the Tetractys, which is the Pythagorean triangle made up of 10 units, sort of dominated philosophical speculation around this time, and you know, Plato being such a follower of Pythagoras, probably wouldn't have cast it in you know, an imperfect or you know, evil kind of role. The second theory that we cover is put forward by a brilliant musicologist named Ernest McLean, and he wrote several books in the late 70s and early 80s, one of which was called The Pythagorean Plato, Prelude to the Song Itself. And in it, he basically goes through every allegory and myth that Plato inserts into his dialogues. And McLean interprets each one of these musically. And you know, much of it is very difficult to understand. As he puts it, you know, for the musically innocent, Atlantis has to remain a mystery. And we were fortunate enough to be able to work with him on this project. He provided an appendix for us, and basically what he says is that Atlantis was destroyed due to just tuning. The idea of just tuning in musicology, I'm going to try to sum this up as quickly as possible, but the idea of just tuning in musicology is sort of working with ideal mathematical ratios, whereas in the real world, ideal mathematical ratios don't play out. They don't line up. So it's ideally perfect, but it's practically impossible. And McLean goes through the mathematics inherent in the Atlantis story and demonstrates very convincingly that all of the mathematics that Plato uses is based upon not only musical principles but specifically just tuning.
So these are the three rings, the five twins, the ten kings. These numbers in Plato's story relate to mathematical or
exactly
musical tunes.
Yeah, and many more besides. Plato in giving these rings and whatnot, he gives very precise dimensions for them. And McLean, seizes upon these dimensions and proves that these were supposed to be musical proportions, and that together they simply didn't line up. Inevitably, the musical proportions would lead to sort of a cacophony of noise that was, you know, indistinguishable as melody or harmony. And because of that, Zeus had to destroy the island in order to bring it back into tune. It's a very interesting sort of theory. It's very abstract. It's probably one of the more unique theories put forward in the last 50 years.
It's intriguing too. You know, something too that ancient cultures seemed to do was sort of layer on meaning to stories. And
absolutely,
you know, you find this with Christ. A simple example, as he said, "As ye sow, so shall ye reap," and you know, every farmer can relate to that.
But exactly.
But it's also a much deeper description of the law of karma, you know, and retribution, that sort of thing. And so it wouldn't be surprising for me to learn that, you know, maybe Atlantis has some basis in truth, something actually destroyed. And yet, as the story is retold over thousands and thousands and thousands of years, all this cosmology is laid on top of it to where,
right,
where it actually becomes more of a cosmological myth and very little of the original.
Right, exactly. And that's absolutely in keeping with sort of the spirit of the book. As I say, we try to make clear at the outset that, you know, this is not the answer that we're presenting here, but it's an aspect, and it's why we feel that, you know, say an interpretation like McLean's, in no way contradicts our own research that we put forward here. So, you know, but it's a fascinating myth.
Okay. Well, and that's about all the time we have, unfortunately, to get into it. But it's something I want to study more, especially the musical part of it. I do want to add that Paramahansa Yogananda, who's one of the saints and sages we've studied because he comments so much on ancient cultures, mentioned that when Atlantis went down, 88 million people died, which leads one to believe that there might be something there too, but then I also need to look at the number 88, figure out what meaning that has.
So. Absolutely. Yeah.
So anyway, hey, great talking to you. We're going to wrap up, but I'll follow up on the telephone with you.
Okay.
Nice having you on the phone, Ian.
Thanks, Ian.
Thank you.
So that's an interesting take on Atlantis. Again, there's over 100 books on the topic. I personally believe that there's some truth to the story and some metaphor to the story, a lot of cosmological aspects. And so I appreciate the book that Ian and Matthew have written because it gives us a greater understanding of the whole topic. And the better we understand these ancient stories, I think the better we understand where we came from and where we're going. And that's important.
Yeah, thanks to Ian for being on the show. And I'd like to remind all of our listeners that Walter has a couple of lecture presentations coming up in England, May 6th in London, as part of the Megalithomania and co-sponsored by the Conscious Events, and then May 9th as part of the main Megalithomania conference in Glastonbury.
That's right. Okay. And so we thank you for turning into the Cosmic Influence. And in the meantime,
bring on the higher ages.